This piece was brought to you by Whole Foods Market, wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening. This is Joshua David Stein from the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. Well, it's the end of the year, which means the holidays, fighting with family. Those are the only two things it means. I guess new beginnings for the year to come. But it's also the time traditionally where I fight with a food frenemy of mine, a man named Josh Ozersky, who is the Esquire editor-at-large, a luminary in the land of food writing. A man who once had gout, he is so devoted to his craft, and the host of and creator of Meatopia. Joshua, are you there?
Yes. How are you, Josh?
I'm doing well, enemy. I
don't think you should say that. If I felt any act of malevolence toward you, I wouldn't enjoy our exchanges of quips and bon mots in the New York Observer the way I do.
But you might be a masochist. I know I am.
Yeah, well, I'd take the fifth on that one.
So, this is the second year we did it. We did it again in 2013 as well. But we go back and forth and we talk about the New York dining scene of the year. Best restaurants, worst restaurants, and things like that, as you know. Josh, I wanted to get your take real quick before we kind of launch into going back and forth about some of our picks. You know, now, you know, in Esquire, I guess you travel around the country, but you spend a fair amount of time here. How did you, and what do you think of the scene, the year? Was it a good year, a bad year? Was it a wash? Was it exciting?
I mean, I think I've sort of gone overboard or perhaps overstated my disaffection with the New York dining scene, or certainly, you know, this sort of my despondency and disappointment with it via a few years ago. Then again, I'm like old now, so it's all like, oh, you know, what happened to the great bands we used to have, you know, like
Pavement.
But the fact of the New York dining scene, I think that is indisputable, I think, for even its sunniest proponents, is that it doesn't have the kind of vital, active, dynamic, original chefs.
But do you
that
think
it once did?
Do you think that once did? I mean, would you pinpoint that? I have a feeling that you're probably talking around like 2003, like the Chang, like explosion. Is that what you have in mind, or do you mean before that? Or when was this golden moment, or was it your golden moment when you were, you know, young?
I mean, I wasn't that young, and it wasn't that golden. It was more, I think, around like 2006, 2007. It was like, I mean, I'm not saying that the chefs that are around now aren't as good as or better than April and David and you know, like the various other, you know, hotshot chefs from back then. You know, in many cases they are better, but they haven't. I mean, and the other thing too is that we're looking at it through the lens of blog hype and, you know, the sort of Beatlemania aspects of that period. But, you know, like, I just don't see anyone out there, other with the possible exception of J.J. Johnson at the Cecil, and I guess there's probably a few guys, you know, like that Indian restaurant that you love so much, you know, that are really doing anything that's comparable to the work that I see in the Deep South or in Portland.
So would you say, which you just moved to bi-coastally, like this week, right?
Yes, I'm sitting in a house surrounded by boxes, and in fact, I just bought a 1996 Eldorado that gave me engine problems at the worst possible time. They had to drive me and my dog back to the house.
Well, you know, the fact that you're in a house at all and that you have a car, I think
you... Yeah, forget about it.
Forget about it.
You forget that, like, you have to practically be an oligarch in New York to have even the most basic, you know, like what Amnesty International would call, like, basic human rights. Yeah. It's unbelievable here. I recommend, you know, everyone
Everyone moved to Portlandia
immediately.
Anyway, I think that your point about New York City dining being, you know, we see that era, right, through the lens of blogging, kind of like hagiography or whatever, the golden lens of that age. At the same time, though, I think now we see our current dining scene through the same lens, but a more dour sort of, you know, Ozersky and misanthropic lens that everything's just kind of meh and shitty. And I think that, you know, as a critic and just as a person eating out, I think people are doing a lot of interesting things. But I also do think that the economic realities of New York, I don't know if they've changed that much since 2003, but it does seem much harder for places like, I don't know, like Momofuku, you know.
Well, right. I mean, let me ask you this. Do you see David Chang opening up a restaurant in the East Village now? Like, or how about this? How about April Bloom? How about a British line cook and come and take over a townhouse in the West Village to sell hamburgers at?
Well, I mean, it wasn't just April, right? It was Jay-Z and Ken Friedman. Yeah. I mean, I think it's become more difficult for upstarts. At the same time, I think maybe New York's loss, even though I don't agree with you that it is a loss, but I think New York's loss is other cities' gain, which I think you mentioned in the piece, like Serpico, right, down in Philadelphia. It's like chefs are finding other markets which allow that sort of creativity. I think the place...
Right, well, that which is everywhere. Like, here, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep interrupting you, Josh.
No, it's fine.
But I was going to say, like, you know, like Gavin Kaysen left town to go back to Minnesota. Jim Meehan moved here to Portland. You know, you see it happening over and over, and it's not so much that there's a brain drain or an exportation of talent. I feel that it's like, here's how I look at it. If you look at, like, the punk scene in London in, whatever, the late 70s or something, or, you know, like the grunge in the Pacific Northwest in the 90s, I mean, that was something that happened, and it was incredibly seminal and influential, and then it left there and took over the rest of the world, and there was nothing to replace it, you know? So, like,
I guess,
when I was
though,
going bi-coastal, everybody, you know, my age was saying, like, oh, you're going to hate the time you spend out of town, you have to eat at Applebee's, you know, like, you can't cook good pizza. I said, you know what?
In Portland?
I didn't like that anymore. Like, everybody has craft cocktails now. Like,
right.
Everybody has a ramen bar. Everybody has Neapolitan pizza.
Right.
And I think that when I'm thinking of New York, there's any number of, like, good restaurants, but they're not different from the same restaurant in Portland or in Austin or whatever. And you know, like, there are a few that are really special. You know, I love Take Root in Brooklyn.
Right.
And but the Cecil's the only one that I can think of that really is truly original. And
I guess, but I one thing about the Cecil...
People who want to do those restaurants, they don't have to do them in New York.
Well, I think
there's communities that will support them, you know, in Baltimore or in Tampa or whatever.
Yes or no? Two things. One, the Cecil. I mean, come on. I should get a shout-out for the Esquire Restaurant of the Year because I was the one who said it was my underrated restaurant in 2013 in this piece in The Observer. Correct?
You did say that?
Yep. I said, most underrated restaurant, the Cecil. Let the record show that.
Well, I didn't.
You didn't read the piece that we wrote together?
Yeah. Well, you know, I only read the parts that I say.
Jesus fucking Christ. I think that explains a lot. But the second thing, which I think is, although that first part is devastating on my part and true, but the second thing is, I do think that there's a level of New York restaurants, and I'm curious on your take because you travel much more than I do, but of places like Awad, which is that high-end regional Indian restaurant, or even Mountain Bird, which I know is now sort of extinct or endangered.
They're going to reopen, though.
They're going to reopen, right? So it does seem that New York does have a sufficiently kind of just the economy of scale that you can have something so precise and so niche, but there will be a market to support that. And I think maybe that is something that's missing in other cities, which could be a promising, you know, way forward for New York cuisine. Like, you're right. Are we going to get another, I don't know, name? Are we going to get another Kraft or, like, a big American like seasonal restaurant. Do we even want that? I don't really need another one of those. But what
well,
I would like
second rate anyway. I mean, they're not Kraft, of course, or Gramercy, which are the great, you know, seminal figures. But like that whole, this is just parenthetical. But the whole like seasonal, local, and everything. I got to tell you one thing. The more time I spend out here, the more sense I get that all that stuff is just like kind of a put on out there, and is also sort of a knockoff. Like out here. Or if, like, you go to San Francisco, the Bay Area, whatever, that local stuff, it means something, and the seasonal stuff means something because they have this incredible resources. They don't have that in New York. Nobody wants to eat seasonal food in winter in New York. It would be like turnips or something, you know?
Right, just menus and menus full of
but
turnips
what were
and
radishes. Before? You were saying that the restaurants that were a little more, like, louche or whatever, that they would find...
Yeah,
what
I guess
you,
my...
What kind of a restaurant were you thinking of in saying that?
Top of my mind is this place, Awad, just because I'm so excited about it because I just ate there, is that it's a pretty specific type of food at a pretty high level, which I don't think would appeal to everyone. And it's a very niche sort of market. And just because New York City is so big and has so many, you know, such a dining culture even now, that those places can be supported here, whereas maybe in a secondary or tertiary market, they wouldn't be so successful. So,
I don't know if I agree with that, because for one thing, New York, I mean, it all starts with the economics, right? I mean, somebody that's got to pay $20,000 a month, you know, and is already paying sky-high food costs and everything, like, for them to make a success, first of all, they're never going to make a lot of money, but for them even to stay in the black... They have to have people, A, come in after it's new, and there's already, you know, when, like, they're not the hot girl, you know, in homeroom anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to have people come in on a Wednesday night. You know what I mean? It's like Tabla. Like, Tabla is a great restaurant. It has a great following. But, like, who wants to go eat a $200 Indian fusion meal on a Wednesday night? You know,
right. But I'm not really talking about Tabla, I guess. I think I'm talking more about smaller and not that expensive places. I guess one parallel, but this is open for debate, obviously. It's mostly just a theory. Los Angeles has a lot of great ethnic food. I'm using air quotes, ethnic food at like very low prices, right? And
right.
I wonder if New York, you know, as a way forward to build out of the ashes of sort of like the fine dining scene and the sort of tired trope of seasonal and regional and all that, seasonal and local, all that stuff. If maybe the way forward is sort of higher end ethnic.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, like that
yeah,
seems
that
like
makes
a.
Sense. What for the Ben. So. What you're saying is, and I think I agree with this, that there's an untapped potential. I mean, the way I think of it is that the middle class no longer exists, in certainly in New York, and it's just become this sort of slobs versus snobs paradigm where, like, you have high-end, like, tweezer food, and then you have, like, you know, sort of like dirtbag, you know, comfort food or whatever, gussied
yeah.
up slightly.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, basically, in many cases, especially in Brooklyn, just, you know, sloppy and half-assed. But, you know, like, there are still those kind of ethnic restaurants, you know, like, when we were talking in the paper and, you know, they were saying, well, what are the good neighborhoods and everything, I really wasn't kidding. When I think of Rego Park, like, I can go to Arzu or Cheburechnia and have, like, totally uncut, straight-up Uzbek food. Or
right.
Burkharan food, you know. And if somebody, like if they had, somebody had a son that was a second generation
exactly.
American and they wanted to do like how David did with his you know, Asian burritos or whatever.
Or Balabusta or like these places which are kind
right.
of, or even in its own way, although it's slightly different, those godforsaken Terese boys who have taken some sort of immigrant cuisine, although a little bit more removed because it's Italian, but have taken some sort of immigrant cuisine, recontextualized it for wealthy Manhattanites,
yeah.
and that's flourishing.
Yeah,
is it the most inclusive?
To me, those guys, honestly, when I look back at the last 10 years, to me, they're the great innovators. To me, they're the ones that have...
But the most
they're the
cynical...
last New York chef that really had a profound effect on gastronomy, I think, because they're the ones that crystallized and executed on the best level the idea of taking vernacular food and making it into, like, you know, one way to, you see people do like.
Yeah, but what they did, I mean, I agree that they're Mario and Rich Terizi are great chefs. Right, but I think it's a very cynical thing which they did, which is they took this vernacular cuisine and sort of fetishized it and made it totally economically inaccessible for most of the people.
Yeah, but you're thinking of Carbone, the original Terizi.
Right, exactly. I agree 100%. Terizi was amazing and so brilliant and so warm-hearted and generous and accessible. But the fact that now they're closing that to make a more exclusive place really shows to me how much they've turned.
Yeah, but they have Parm, too, don't forget. I mean, and they're going to do other concepts like Parm. It is true, though. There was something beautiful that with Terizi, you could go in at lunch and have, like, the best turkey sandwich of all time. Like, all that art and all that technique and skill going to making a perfect turkey sandwich. To me, that was, like, the highest calling. But then at night, they would have, like, you know, a simple osteria menu. They don't do that anymore, and that's, I think, a function of New York's, you know, sort of like, I don't know, I mean, identity politics or something. Like, you're either, if you're not, like my friend Andrew Friedman really summed it up and boiled it down, if you're not rich, you're poor.
Right.
You know?
So I don't know. I feel like
you go to Parm and eat your meatball sandwich, or you go to Carbone and eat a $50 veal chop.
I feel like it has more to do with a little bit of economics, but a lot of sort of personal greed and ambition. Joshua, I have to say, for being my sworn blood enemy, this was a lovely conversation. I think you brought up a lot of great points. I'm glad you're bi-coastal, because if you weren't here anymore, even though you might not miss New York, New York would miss you. So I want to say thank you, and I hope...
Thank you, Josh. I appreciate it, and I keep up the good work. We need the acerbic and dissonant voices like your own to break through the white noise, you know...
Of the food establishment.
Hype core.
Okay, well, have a wonderful new year, and I'll see you in 2015.
Okay, thank you, Josh. Bye-bye.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
Welcome back to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, Half Hour. I'm your host, Joshua David Stein, and my guest is Kyle Forrester. Now, Kyle is the author of the musical guest intro song and the theme song for the whole program. Kyle, thanks for coming.
Hey, thanks, Joshua.
And thank you for writing our songs.
No problem. I'd say they're co-writes with yourself.
Well, you know, that brings us to the reason why I have you on, other than you're my friend, is we have a new project that I'd like to have the world debut on the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour half hour on Heritage Radio. Another reason to keep on listening. This album, it's actually an EP, which will come out the beginning of next year, is inspired by my children and also Brian Lehrer from WNYC, the host of a tremendous show from 10 to 12 weekdays. And it's called Songs for Children I've Had. I have two kids, Augie and Achilles, and Kyle very wonderfully has translated some of the songs I've written into serviceable and indeed transcendent tracks.
Serviceable and indeed transcendent.
That is like pitchfork quality. Anyway, Kyle, let's play first a song for my kids, and this is a song inspired by my taking them to school every day. There's also a little bit of a Yin Yang Twins influence, a little bit of Outkast, and a little bit of Dave Brubeck. The song is called Augie and Achilles Are Going to School.
The point.
Well, that was a creepy yet catchy song about taking my children to school.
Yeah.
Are you happy to have been a part of creating that?
I am. Is that a song that you, do you sing that to your kids?
Achilles knows Augie and Achilles are going to school, because I'll say Augie and Achilles are going to school.
Mm.
He doesn't know the source material, which is the Yin Yang Twins Whisper song, which has all sorts of words that even you and I aren't feeling comfortable saying.
Yes.
So as in the first album, Forrester Sings Stein was about women I wanted to have sex with, and in some cases did have sex with, including my wife, but then also Lewis Lapham.
Whoa.
Who I didn't have sex with and didn't want to have sex with, but he was a father figure to me and someone I really looked up to. So I had written a song for him, which is on that first record. Now, this record, I want to close out the entire season dedicating it to the man who's the subject of this song. I got my start in radio as an intern at the Brian Lehrer Show, and I listen religiously, as does Kyle Forrester.
I do every day.
So to take us out, the last song of the season is a song that I wrote and Kyle sings on, as he does the entire album, called Brian Lehrer. Before we play it, I'd just like to say, if anyone wants to get a copy of this EP, I guess they should just email me at joshuadavidstein@gmail.com, and I'll send a copy your way. Kyle?
I think it's going to be ready for Valentine's Day.
It's a very romantic album, because as the great erotic artist slash children's book illustrator Tommy Ungerer said, when confronted by librarians about how could he possibly create children's books and pornography, he said, well, without fucking, there wouldn't be kids anyway. So this song, with that, here is Brian Lehrer.
I listen to your show every morning, but it's always the show from the day before. And because it's a podcast, I can't call in to tell your guests what I'm thinking and join the discussion. You have such a lovely way with your callers. Everybody feels they've had their say. But because it's a podcast, I can't call in and add my voice to the discussion. Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer Show.
Aggressive, ongoing, but incomplete, which is at the heart of your criticism. In what ways was it aggressive? What has it accomplished, in your opinion, that you hope to further? Yeah,
we were borrowing terms that were used by the folks who established the
listeners. Questions or comments for U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, post them to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Would it be fair to say, however, that the commission was impaneled?
I wonder who you'll have on your show today. I guess I'll have to find out tomorrow. When it's a podcast and I can't call in and tell your guests what I'm thinking and join the discussion. Do you remember I was once a guest on your show? It was the best day of my life, but I can't find the podcast, so I can't listen to when I was a guest on the show, part of the discussion. Brian Lehrer Show.
York Times has been doing a lot of things on it.
When you say addict, do I see that you told my screener you drank 20 bottles a day?
In fact, I blogged about this, because each time I try to give it up, if I told you the hits that I get, thousands.
Jazz and country. That's the most effective way of applying pressure to change behavior. So why wouldn't the government, the same government, use that same standard with people at the top of the banking industry?
You're analogizing to Crimea. Okay.
I'm analogizing the U.S. government, the Obama administration, which I think appointed you, going after...
Well, that's about it for this season of Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. I want to thank all the people who have been listening to this show. My mother. I'd like to thank everyone here at Heritage Radio. Jack Inslee, Aaron Fairbanks, and the lovely Liz Smith. I'd like to thank all of our guests this season. And tonight I'd like to thank Josh Ozersky and Kyle Forrester. This is Joshua David Stein saying good night and Happy New Year.
Joshua David Stein, Variety Hour.
Joshua David Stein, Variety Hour.
Half Hour.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.